know, everybody just knows everybody, it seems like, and it is hard when something bad happens to people.
Rangel mourns the loss of three residents. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, House leaders and the fracture over an oil tax revision.
Some think it's too much, some think it's not enough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
National Transportation Safety Board investigators have begun the work of determining why a Rangel plane crashed Friday morning on Admiralty Island. Three people died and a fourth was badly injured when the Cessna 206 hit the 2,200-foot elevation about 20 miles southeast of Angoon. Alaska State Troopers identified the victims as 60-year-old David Gala, 61-year-old Greg Sheff, and 57-year-old Thomas Sikowich, all of Rangel. The fourth person on board was 21-year-old Morgan Enright, who is from Ketchikan. She was rescued and medevaced to Seattle. As of this afternoon, she remained in critical condition at Harborview Medical Center's intensive care unit. Safety Board investigator Sean Williams says a preliminary report will be issued in 5 to 10 days, but a final determination of cause could take around a year.
All wreckage has been recovered. It is in Juneau in a hangar, and we're actually conducting a detailed wreckage layout and examination at this time.
He says the plane was relatively intact at the crash site and was removed in three pieces by helicopter. Rangel residents are mourning the loss of three members of their 2,400-person town. Jeff J. Bush is the Southeast Alaska Community's borough manager.
You know, everybody just knows everybody, it seems like, and it is hard when something bad happens to people, and because everybody kind of is involved in the whole thing.
He says community members are pitching in to help families of the victims. Rangel medical provider Alaska Island Community Services is offering counseling assistance to community members. The Senate Finance Committee is looking to reroute money from a fund to offset the high cost of electricity in rural areas. Some of power cost equalization money would replace the community revenue sharing program that the state government started when oil prices were higher. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Senators may link two changes they've been considering this legislative session. Senate Bill 210 would reduce the amount that municipalities receive in revenue sharing. But there was a problem with this idea. Without a source of revenue other than the state's annual budget, this program, which legislators want to rename community assistance, would disappear. That's where the second change comes in. Senate Bill 196 would use money from the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund to offset some of the state budget. But under a new version, this money would instead go to assist communities. Fairbanks Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy asked why the PCE fund isn't being used to close the budget gap.
We're experiencing a $4 billion hole. There's $1 billion in this fund. And just a thought as to why wouldn't we use this fund to at least backfill some of the deficit? And I certainly understand the assistance that it gives to many of our communities.
Under the latest version of both bills, the $900 million PCE fund would continue to be used primarily for a program to help rural electric ratepayers. But in years when the fund earns more than is needed for that program, up to $30 million would go to community assistance, and up to $25 million would go to rural, bulk fuel, and renewable energy programs. Bethel Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman supports both bills. He doesn't want to spend the PCE money all at once, like Dunleavy suggested. Hoffman says the fund could provide a lasting source for both power cost equalization and community assistance, as long as the main PCE fund remains intact. That will help communities that have come to rely on revenue sharing while taking pressure off of the state budget.
If the dollars were taken, they would be a one-time use, and people in rural Alaska would end up paying substantially more in electric costs.
But not all municipalities are happy about the change. Anchorage would receive $2 million, which is $9 million less than the revenue sharing it got this year. Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's chief of staff, Suzanne Fleet Green, says it will cost residents more in taxes or reduce services. The municipal government had budgeted for a $5 million reduction and must make up the gap.
To counteract the effects of this legislation, the municipality will have to add to the additional burden being felt by property owners in the municipality. This bill effectively is shifting an additional $4 million to property taxpayers in Anchorage, Eagle River, Chugiak, Girdwood, and all other parts of the municipality.
Under the latest changes, municipalities would receive $30 million in community assistance, compared with $50 million in Governor Bill Walker's budget. Rural communities are largely protected from community assistance cuts. An extreme example is Aleutians East Borough, which receives nearly $10,000 for every resident who lives in unincorporated areas. Every community with fewer than 500 residents would receive at least $400 per resident in state assistance, while Anchorage would receive $7.73 per resident. Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Kathy Wasserman says she can support using the Power Cost Equalization Fund for community assistance. But the reduced amount of aid, combined with a formula that benefits some places more than others, puts her in a difficult position.
I've just had trouble with the formula that's presently in place. No matter which direction the Alaska Municipal League goes, whether to support the formula or not support, I throw a number of my municipalities under the bus. So that's why we're just not taking a position on the formula at this point.
Both houses have until Sunday to act on the bills. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
For the second time in 2 days, House lawmakers have postponed a final vote on the governor's controversial oil tax bill. The bill is a cornerstone of Governor Bill Walker's efforts to close the state's $4 billion budget deficit. Walker's proposal would have brought in more than $400 million a year by raising the minimum oil tax and rolling back subsidies to smaller oil companies. The House has scaled the bill back significantly, but as APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, the Republican-controlled majority still doesn't have the votes to pass it.
Can the House please come to order?
House Bill 247, which revises the state's oil tax and credit system, was on the calendar Monday morning. But when House Speaker Mike Chenault arrived at that item on the agenda,
this time I'm going to roll House Bill 247 to tomorrow's calendar.
Postponed, to give the House Majority Caucus time to iron out differences among its members. Chenault, an Ekiski Republican, says right now he's hearing dissent from all sides.
Some think it's too much, some think it's not enough.
That is, some lawmakers worry the bill doesn't go far enough to make a real dent in the budget, while others worry it goes too far, threatening to undermine the oil industry and is yet another rewrite of Alaska's tax code after a major overhaul just 3 years ago. The current bill would step down cash credits available to companies in Cook Inlet, limit incentives for new oil on the North Slope, and set a hard minimum 2% oil tax, among other things. Most of its provisions wouldn't go into effect until at least 2017. In the years after that, it would still only raise about a quarter to half of what the governor proposed. Representative Les Guerra, a minority Democrat from Anchorage, says that's not enough. Under the current regime, the state expects to pay out about $1.3 billion just in cash credits between this year and next. Guerra says there's no way to close the budget gap without major changes to the credit program.
What's their plan? Is their plan to cut the dividend by more? Is their plan to raise $300 million more in an income tax? This is the easiest way to save money.
As for Chenault, his goal is to hash out a compromise that's acceptable to his majority caucus members. The bill is scheduled to come up for a vote again on Tuesday. How confident are you that it's going to come up for a vote tomorrow morning?
More, I'd probably have about as much confidence as... No.
So maybe not that confident. But Chenault says he is hopeful. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Congress is back in Washington this week. High on its to-do list is passing an FAA bill before legal authority for the aviation agency expires in mid-July. The House bill includes a controversial provision that would privatize air traffic control, but that bill is in a holding pattern and hasn't been approved by the full House. The Senate is trying to pass its own bill. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says it's good for passengers.
It includes a number of consumer-friendly provisions, like fee disclosures and refunds for lost bags or services paid for but not received.
McConnell says the Senate improved its bill last week with new security requirements.
The amendment will help shore up security measures for international flights coming into the U.S., as well as improve vetting and inspections of airport employees.
The Senate bill does not include privatizing air traffic control, but it's still attracting controversy. Democrats are trying to insert a package of unrelated tax credits for clean energy, such as geothermal, biomass, and fuel cell projects. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Senate passes an overhaul of the state's criminal justice system.
We will be monitoring the success of the changes we've made and make sure that it delivers the results that we expect to see delivered.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
A helicopter carrying a rescue crew has landed at the base of Bear Glacier in the Harding Ice Fields near Seward, where two hikers became stranded over the weekend. 36-year-old Jennifer Nyman of Wrangell and 45-year-old Christopher Hanna of Soldotna were reported stranded on the glacier in Kenai Fjords National Park Saturday afternoon, according to an Alaska State Trooper dispatch. Staff Sergeant Edward Egerton, a spokesman for the Alaska Rescue Coordination Center at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage, says a helicopter carrying the crew landed around noon at the base of Bear Glacier and were waiting for the weather to clear to fly to the hikers. Egerton says weather and terrain will not allow the ground crew to search for them. Nyman and Hannah had been dropped off by airplane for a day hike on Friday and were supposed to get picked up that evening. The weather changed and the pilot was not able to pick them up. Egerton says the RCC took the lead on the rescue from troopers on Sunday and they were able to get a flight out to the glacier today. Egerton says Nyman and Hannah have been communicating through an in-reach satellite locator beacon.
The coordinates that they provided through their in-reach beacon put them at approximately 4,300 feet in elevation on the Bear Glacier in the Harding Ice Field, and they had communicated that their tent had failed, they were running low on supplies, the weather was getting worse, and so they ended up having to dig in and make a snow cave for shelter.
Nyman is a well-known journalist on the Kenai Peninsula, where she is the owner-editor of the Readout Reporter. She has also worked for KDLL Public Radio in Kenai. A 41-year-old Sitka man missing in a kayak since Thursday morning is presumed dead. The Coast Guard suspended the search for 41-year-old Jesse Mills on Friday afternoon. Mills was reported missing by his wife after he failed to return from a solo kayaking trip on Wednesday night. During a first light search on Friday, an Air Station Sitka MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter discovered an overturned kayak on Cassiana Island. A diver recovered the kayak wedged between rocks with a paddle attached, but a thorough search of the island with search dogs and crew turned up no other signs of Mills. Lance Ewers is the captain of Sitka Search and Rescue. His local agency, along with the Sitka Fire Department, the Sitka Police Department, and several Good Samaritan vessels, banded together to search for Mills.
There's a number of folks that self-volunteered and self-deployed and just wanted to be out there helping with an extra set of eyes.
Mills left his home in the 1400 block of Halbert Point Road at 10 p.m. on Wednesday night after telling his wife he was going for a walk. The weather that evening was rainy, with winds of 15 to 25 miles per hour. Viewers noted that Mills did not leave a float plan.
Nobody saw him go out in the kayak, and, you know, it was nighttime when he left.
Mills and his wife, Amy, moved to Sitka from Chico, California, 2 months ago. Several friends and coworkers set out in private vessels to search for Mills. In a press release, Lieutenant Stacy Tate, a search and rescue mission coordinator at Coast Guard Sector Juneau, said the decision to suspend a search is never an easy one to make and is done with great care and deliberation. The state Senate voted 16-2 on Saturday to pass a bill overhauling Alaska's criminal justice system. The bill would divert nonviolent offenders from prison toward alternative programs. It shifts the focus of bail from people's ability to pay to the risk they present. It also creates a reentry program in the Department of Corrections to assist those leaving prison to help reduce recidivism. Senate Bill 91 reduces sentence ranges and expands parole. North Pole Republican Senator John Coghill says the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission laid the groundwork for the bill.
If less people are coming into jail, reoffending, that's less crime. And that's what our aim is here. The aim here is not necessarily cost savings, but we can't afford to do what we're doing right now. So we're kind of bumping up against the cost and the unacceptable returns on what's going on in Alaska.
The Department of Corrections forecasts the bill will save a lot of money. $90 million would be saved in the next 6 years by diverting people from prison and potentially hundreds of millions in reduced social service costs, since people will be working instead of being in jail. Law enforcement unions and some victims' rights advocates oppose the bill. They say it jeopardizes public safety and worsens victims' trauma. Chugiak Republican Senator Bill Stoltz opposed the bill.
I really think in many aspects this bill got too big to fail, and it could be several bills that were dealt with in different iterations.
But supporters pointed to research showing that similar measures in other states have reduced the chance that people will reoffend. Bill supporter Soldotna Republican Senator Pete Michicki says the current system makes low-level offenders better at being criminals while incarcerated rather than being reformed. The bill would reinvest some of the savings towards social assistance programs to help them succeed in finding work.
What we've tried to do is to provide intervention and reinvestment while they're inside, and hopefully have these folks ready to succeed when they're released. This is not the end, although it's a paradigm shift. We will be monitoring the success of the changes we've made and make sure that it delivers the results that we expect to see delivered.
The House Judiciary Committee is scheduled to discuss the bill today, putting it on track for a vote by the full House later this week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Tribal representatives from across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta met in Bethel recently to hold what they called a special convention of the Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, the regional tribal nonprofit for 56 villages across the YK Delta. But the group left with their questions unanswered. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur was there and has this story.
We're AVCP. We should not be ignored. We have questions that need to be answered.
That's Ivan Ivan, chairman of the gathering and chief of the native village of Akiak. In February, Ivan resigned from the AVCP executive board. About 25 people showed up both days of the meeting. 8 were delegates, representing villages across the Delta. But to make a quorum, the meeting needed 38 delegates. Unable to take action on their agenda, the group turned to defining AVC's power structure and claiming authority within it. Their message, AVCP members are the organization's true board, and the administration and executive board answer to them. Here's how Nick Andrew Jr., delegate from the Native Village of Marshall and vice chair of the gathering, put it.
We are entitled as board members for disclosure or answers, honesty, transparency.
All those things the group claims is what they aren't getting and haven't been getting for months as a series of AVCP issues have come to light. In December, AVCP laid off 30 employees, citing changing economic times. In January, KYUK reported the administration's almost decade-long mishandling of money from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family, or TANF funds, which are federal dollars designated for low-income families. Later that month, the executive board rescheduled a special convention from February to June without consulting its delegates, who voted for the earlier date. Then, in February, the executive board announced the shutdown of its Ashanivik Hotel. Again, Vice Chair Nick Andrew Jr.
When something has gone terribly wrong, which has, the board has every right to exercise and flex our political might.
The meeting's agenda called for the AVCP chief financial officer and executive board chairman to explain under oath the decisions surrounding these controversies, but neither official appeared at the meeting, which disappointed Willie Addy, vice president of the Kwigilinak IRA.
These are valid agenda items. That's what I came for. And for the e-board or the AVCP's administrative level, seems like there's a hindrance to its village members who they represent.
In March, Executive Board Chairman Henry Hunter Sr. sent a letter to the tribes saying the meeting is not an AVCP-sponsored event. The word not in the letter is capitalized and underlined. AVCP bylaws say a special convention requires the approval of 2/3 or 38 tribes. At the end of the first day, the gathering appointed 3 members to go to the AVCP building and summon President and CEO Myron Nanning to attend the next day's meeting. Vice Chair Andrew was one of those selected and says Nanning responded through a receptionist that he was too busy to attend. The next day, neither Nanning nor anyone from AVCP administration or the executive board showed up. The group plans to network among the tribes to get their questions for AVCP on the agenda for the June AVCP-sponsored special convention. This year is an election year for AVCP leadership. Nanning won the last election by 1 vote and has served as president for 24 years. Nanning did not respond to KYUK's request for comment. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
An international team of explorers recently completed a 700-mile journey from the Arctic Ocean to Eagle. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Winds were howling on February 28th when the 3 explorers set down on Herschel Island, just off the coast of Yukon Territory, about 50 miles east of the U.S.-Canada border. A breathless videographer announced their arrival after they flew in from Inuvik, Northwest Territories.
Well, here they are, Tim Oakley, Wayne Hall, Graham Burke, out here on Herschel Island.
Oakley, Burke, and Hall had already been on the trail for 8 days. After a 24-hour layover on the island, they set out for the return trip to Eagle on the route Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen took in 1905 after he'd navigated the Northwest Passage, the first recorded transit of the icy route along Canada's northern coast. Amundsen went to Eagle because it was the closest telegraph station, and Oakley says he wanted to get the word out about his historic voyage.
So he wanted to tell the world that he'd done it, and he made a 700-mile sledging journey from Herschel Island to Eagle.
Oakley was born in Canada and grew up in the United Kingdom, and he's a fellow with the Royal Geographical Society. He says the organization supported the expedition in part as a learning opportunity for students in Alaska, Canada, Norway, and the UK, who were able to monitor his journey through a blog he posted to the project website titled In Amundsen's Footsteps.
The educational program is to highlight the fragility in of the Arctic regions and climatically what is happening up there.
Oakley says this wasn't a scientific expedition, but rather a journey that might offer a snapshot of changes underway in the region. For example, he says Amundsen traveled over the frozen Yukon River when he set out in October 1905, which might not be possible today.
Last year, the river didn't freeze up at Eagle until about mid-December.
Oakley says the warming climate probably led to the early breakup and overflow of the Firth River in far northern Yukon Territory. The backing up river soaked the three mushers and their dogs on the second day of the journey, and they spent a miserable 48 hours waiting for winds to die down.
I think for all of us, the Firth was the most difficult part of the whole expedition. It was extreme.
Burke says Hall's savvy helped the team survive the ordeal.
I don't know that we would have got through without Wayne's skills.
Oakley says his team had been trying to maintain the same time frame as Amundsen's expedition, but he says they picked up the pace near the end of the journey as they were approaching Eagle.
The weather started to get warmer and warmer, and the snow conditions were becoming difficult, and running dogs in hot weather is not particularly desirable.
Oakley and Burke say the huskies Hall raised at his home in Eagle deserve most of the credit for the successful expedition. He says they also appreciate support from others who run or race dogs.
I think the heroes of this, as Graham has pointed out, is the dogs. They are exceptional dogs, and I think we were very lucky that we had a lot of mushers from the Yukon Quest and from the Iditarod who were following us.
Burke, who's worked with dogs in his native New Zealand, says the team's respect for animals shows another important difference between the two expeditions.
Back in Amundsen's days, the dogs were it's an expendable commodity, if you like.
Burke says all 22 huskies returned home safely, and he says one even gained a few pounds out on the trail. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Daisha Eaton in Homer, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.